Questlove Supreme is a production of iHeartRadio. This classic episode was produced by the team at Pandora. Previously on QLS Classic with Bootsy Collins, he told us about growing up in Cincinnati, Ohio, meeting his idol James Brown, and James Brown taking him under his wing, taking him all the way to Africa to see Fela, and then coming back to build the P-Funk empire. You do not want to miss part two of the Bootsy Collins episode on QLS, y'all. QLS Classic, to be a matter of fact.
Okay, what in the hell are we going to do now? You know, because I knew that was it. You know, it's like, we got to go. So we sitting on the bus. We all, the whole band, sitting on the bus, you know, looking at each other on Trailway. I know we're
Trailway, right here, man. Yep.
Yeah,
I remember taking them.
But. Trailway bus, man. And, you know, we looking at each other, and then they looking at me like, okay, what are we going to do now since you went in there and, you know,
messed
you,
it up.
You messed it all up.
You didn't ask right.
Yeah.
Right,
yeah,
right. You didn't ask right.
And so, you know, that was wearing me out. I started feeling like, dang, what are we going to do? So the next thing came to my mind is, you're going to go to Cincinnati, you're going to practice, you're going to get in that basement, you're going to practice, you're going to get tight, and you're going to go to Detroit, you know, and see what happens. Because, you know, that's what we were into, taking people's gigs, you know.
Now, why Detroit? Did you think, like, maybe Motown could sign us?
Yeah,
or
yeah.
Was Westbound a thing
well,
by
actually,
then?
Well, actually, let me tell you why Detroit. Billy from the Spinners called and asked, told us that he needed a band, and he also needed a lead singer. And, you know, Felipe Wynn, which is Phil So Walker, he was singing with us before we got with James, after we got left James, right after we got, you know, left. And so we already had the lead singer. We didn't know it, but I told him, I was like, Billy, we got the lead singer you need, man. I said, we'll play behind y'all, you know, but seriously, we did not want to play behind another set of singers if, you know, if it killed us, you know, because you got to understand the time that it was coming through, sliding them, these bands was coming up. We wanted to be a band.
Crazy ideas.
Yeah.
Right?
You know, we wanted to dress crazy, act a fool, and do anything we wanted to do. And singers wouldn't let us do it.
Suit and tie.
Yeah, yeah. And so we was really through with that. So we go to Detroit, you know, on Billy's dime. And once we get to Detroit, we play and take a few gigs, right? We take it to the stage,
okay.
All right? Take some gigs. And when we did that, I met this young lady named Malia Franklin. And she was tied with George Clinton. And because her sister was dating George. Mm-hmm. So she knew him and she wanted to take me over to meet him because, you know, y'all look just like Funkadelic. Y'all sound like him. You know, y'all need to hook up. So she convinced me. And I'm like, yeah, I got to go meet this mom. I say, yeah, we've been wanting to take it to the stage on the mom. Anyway, you know, where they at?
You know. Were you were fully aware of Funkadelic by this point?
Not fully. We had just been hearing about them.
Okay.
You know, it's like everywhere we went, it's like, man, y'all look like Funkadelic. Y'all sound like them. You know, so everywhere we went, it was like it followed us.
So about what year is this around?
This is like 72.
Okay. Gotcha.
Yeah. And so we heard that so much, you know, it was like, then when we got to Detroit, you know, it was like, okay, I need to meet George. So Malia sets up the meeting. I go over there, get with George. You know, that's a whole story in itself, which is another 3 or 4 hours. You know,
was it love at first sight when y'all first met each other?
Yeah, basically, you know, I knocked on the door and the door kind of the creepy thing, Adam's Family thing. So it kind of creeped open, and I heard a voice say, come on in. And so I kind of, you know, walked in, and I saw this black light, and I immediately, it was like, oh, shoot. You know, I went straight to the black light. You know, then I looked right down below it. This mug is sitting in a Buddha stance, right, with a sheet, white sheet on. Now, picture this in a black light. White sheet on and chicken feet. Yellow chicken feet. Yeah, he's sitting there like this on the floor, like this, you know, and he's just sitting there in the corner. And he's got a half moon on one side, star on the other, the rest of his ball is here. And he is looking just as crazy as, I mean, you know, and when I seen it, it was like, whatever he's talking about, I want in. Whatever it is. I mean, whatever he says, you know, I already know about the money thing, you know, and why, I was not into that. I was into, if you just let me get in, I will produce. I will give it to you. I lay it on you, you know. And, you know, I didn't have to go through all that with George. He was like, you know, you just come on in here and help me with this Parliament, this Funkadelic, these records I got to do. Just come on in here and do that. And on down the line, you know, I'll get you a deal, a record deal, you and the band. At that point, it wasn't about getting me a deal. It was about getting the band a deal. Yeah. You know, and he's the one, George is the one to talk me into doing the solo thing. Cause I wasn't down with that. It was like, man, we're a band. I mean, you know, I had always been used to being a band and I never even entertained the idea of me doing so. I can't sing, man. What am I going to do? You know,
be boozy.
That's exactly what he said.
So I mean, you're the first larger than life character, like your persona supersedes your already powerful catalog, and you know your name is associated with a lot of megaton hits in the P-Funk
universe.
Songbook. Yeah.
Right.
So right. How did he finally truly convince you that this has to happen? And you know
what, he didn't have to convince me. I mean, he already knew about us, you know, from the James Brown thing. So he knew more about us than I knew about him, you know.
So he studied you guys.
Yeah, he knew. I mean, George is a silent genius. I mean, that mug is, I can't say enough about him and how he have moved through not only the music, but the business. All of us could use a bit more of what we're lacking, but him as a person, he, you know, the thing that messes us all up is the flesh. Mm-hmm. If we didn't have flesh, we'd be cool. We'd be really cool because we wouldn't have to take care of this, you know, and we wouldn't be so addicted, you know, or addictable, mm-hmm. you know. And so those are the things that caught him, you know. Well, it catches not just him, it catches all of us. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know. And so, but his mind was just so, I mean, he's the one that got me into reading and being up on the mothership and, clones. And
let me ask you this, style-wise, at this point, where were you and how did you get there from James, right? Because when you met George, I'm imagining that you were...
I was already there.
Okay, so how did...
But offstage, he was dressing crazy. On stage, he had the suit and tie with James.
Okay, yeah. Okay. And then, so and George did enhance that.
You did influence James a little bit because, like...
He started dressing
a little
like...
dashiki, yeah. And, right. You know.
Yeah.
Or you got, what was the term, Hank Bailey? Blackenized.
Right. Well, actually, that's what James named us first.
Oh, y'all was Blackenized?
The Blackenizers.
Wow.
That was, you know, he named us that before the JBs. We was the Blackenizers. And he sent us out with Hank Ballard. So it was Hank Ballard, Hank Ballard and the Midnighters, and the Blackenizers band.
So you guys are the band on that record as well?
On the
Hank Ballard record?
Which one? Now, Now the ones like around in the twist time, we wasn't.
No. I'm talking about the James Brown.
How you gonna
get respect if you haven't cut your?
That was Macy O'Neal.
From the Left Side, at least, or I know he had one record out in 70. That was
us.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So the sound of P-Funk is actually the opposite of James Brown.
Yeah. Yeah.
Who's crafting the sound of it, and was it that much of a science, or was it just whatever you felt?
Let me tell you exactly how it was. Everybody that was involved brought their signature and was allowed to use it. In other words, George gave me an opportunity to get in the studio and find myself, you know, and that is what, you know, I didn't get from James. So what I got from James was the ABC, like the discipline.
Fundamentals.
You know, then what I got with George, with George's whole thing was, whatever the funk you got, bring it. And so I was never at a standstill. I was always, that's why I wasn't ever going back listening. I was always, it's like George said, whatever I got. So I got to see what I got. Mm-hmm. You know,
a lot of freedom.
He allowed me to have that freedom to find myself. He allowed Bernie to have that freedom to find himself. And it just so happened that all that stuff worked. The magic was coming from each mug. You know, it wasn't like we planned it or planned the sound or... You know, the sound was, anytime I'm with Bernie, with Catfish, you know, it's going to sound that way. You know?
How long were all those records, did they take? I've read stories of them, y'all cutting records in like a week, week and a half.
Yeah.
How would the average studio session work?
Well, we didn't have no plan, first of all.
Just whatever happened.
Yeah, yeah, you know, we just go in the studio and start cutting. George say, I like this for Funkadelic. I like that for Parliament. I like that for Parlade and da 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 da. You know, so it went like that. We were just recording. We wasn't thinking.
Just cutting.
We wasn't thinking about what we had to cut.
One question I always had, Glenn Goins, because you're the only person I met that, you know, I actually worked with him.
Yeah.
What was he like, man? He was such an incredible voice, dude.
Yeah.
What was he?
Well, not only was he an incredible voice, his songwriting ability, along with his guitar playing, you know, actually that's him playing 12 string on Munchies. Yeah, that's Glenn playing 12 string guitar. Yeah.
So, okay, not many people know that for a lot of those Parliament songs,
yeah,
you're drumming on it.
Yeah.
Which I want to know. I mean, now I appreciate it, but for me, like, the sound of funk and the sound of raw soul was always James Brown-esque, like tight snares,
right.
high-tuned stuff. You guys were the opposite of that. So what was the ideology behind, like, the lowest tuned snare ever and, you know, playing, like, unorthodox rhythms? Like, I know Jerome also, you know, he shouldn't be slept on as far as his Jerome Bigfoot really? Brett. Yeah, but what just with the age of synthesizers, which I know, like, everyone, especially with Stevie.
Yeah. Yeah.
That sounded futuristic and right up there with you guys. But just as far as like slowing the pace down, like a lot, like Dr. Funkenstein is so slow.
Well, that was.
And anti-disco, like what?
That for me was what funk was. I mean, it felt like that. I mean, you know, you don't do the rabbit thing. I mean, you know, when you get on a chick, you know, it's like making love. You know, it ain't about being a rabbit. You know, you got to be a slow go. Slow go that funk down so she can feel it.
He needs his own love advice show.
I mean, listen.
She wants to feel it, man.
Yes, she does.
Yeah.
Just in case you needed a witness.
I'm jumping all over the place, but I know that we might as well start the regret questions now.
I know, right? Yeah.
So, okay. Now
you say start the questions.
The ones that we know we're gonna forget.
We have regret questions that we think of now and then forget about because we're on a tangent. Okay, so in 78, mm-hmm. and again, I'm just jumping all over the place. In 78, Bootzilla is absolutely inescapable.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, what Brickhouse was for 76 and what Flashlight was for 77.
Right, right.
I mean, at this point, I felt like your second album was slightly bigger than Motor Booty Affair.
Yeah.
So my question is, with Bootzilla, it never occurred to none of you to just call that song Wind Me Up?
Well,
because I'm just saying that to buy that record in the record store.
Let me explain it.
Yeah. We would just say,
you got to understand the mentality wasn't buy this. The mentality was I was building a character. And Bootzilla was the character, not Wind Me Up.
Branding.
But not even in parentheses. Yeah. Like,
No.
We even had Star Trek.
No. And see, Star Trek, right? And if you notice, on the album, there's nothing about Bootzilla on that album. Bootsy? ?
Mm-hmm. I always wanted to know about that.
So it wasn't. We wanted to go break all the rules, all of the things you just saying. You know, we wanted to break all of those. So we put emphasis on, okay, what we gonna call it? And George would say, and I say, well, how about Rubber Ducky? It had nothing to do with the song.
I realize that there's a lot of titles in which are never.
But we only pretty much did that on my stuff. You know, some of the other things did that. But if you notice on the Bootsy Rubber Band stuff, a lot of the titles had nothing to do with the songs.
How did y'all come up with What's a Telephone Bill?
Hello, baby. Yes, it's your friendly phone fanatic again.
Well, that's one of my love songs, man.
I love that song.
What it is I used, you know, when I used to go to school, it was like this one girl I just, you know, I messed around, got some mouth from, right?
Nigga, yo.
All right. What? Now check it out. Check it out. You know, her daddy was a preacher.
Yes.
You know, and some kind of way I was planted to where I got in, I hit that mouth, and I got out. You know what I'm saying? So, you know, in doing so, I got real, you know, I don't think it was, well, it might have been love, but I think it was more so lust.
Turned out.
Yeah, I think it was more so luck. And then every chance I got, I was on the, you know, the phone booth.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
I was in the phone booth calling her, talking about what time can I get some more of that mouth? I need some mouth right now. Okay? And so, you know, that was the whole conversation. And, you know, I would carry that conversation out because if I couldn't see her, because, you know, dad got this strict, you know, preacher thing going on. So I had to make, you know, make adjustments here and there. Whatever time I can get that mouth, I had to sneak in, sneak out. So, and I did all that on the telephone.
Okay.
And so the whole thing came down to, if I can get your loving, I mean, What's a telephone bill? Yeah. I mean, it didn't matter. Wow. I mean, you know, if I can get that some of that mouth,
telephone bill ain't nothing.
Because yes. I was getting the nickel back anyway.
Right, right.
You know, because, you know, we knew how to work them telephone booths. You know?
Oh, my God.
Oh, yeah.
And so are these lyrics like the hook, but then all the stuff you're saying in the middle, that's just you. Are you making that ad-libbing up as you go along? Just ad-libbing?
And then George wrote a lot of that one, too.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, but the hook of the whole thing was, you know, the whole purpose of it was to get the word out about, you know, if I can get some of that mouth, what's the telephone bill? And that was it.
Okay.
What Fonte was saying. So when you're in concert, and a lot of these songs, don't have traditional verses to it.
Verse hook. Or, yeah.
It's just you doing dialogue, like Hollywood Squares or
Hallelujah.
Whatever. I mean, just talking.
Yeah.
Would your audience mouth that back to you as if, and would they be disappointed if you went off script? Like, would you have to recite your dialogue?
Pretty. I mean, they want to hear it. They don't have to hear it exact, but they want to hear it. They want to hear some of it. You know, they would love to hear all of it. But if for some reason I don't do it that night, it's all right because they're going to get some of it anyway. You know, but I don't know. The audience has been really good for me throughout the career. So it's like Funketeers is Funketeers, man. I mean, you know, they just come to, you know, they want to give up some funk and then they want to get some funk.
What was the touring like for you? Because, I mean, by that point, black theater really wasn't invented. I mean, you know, your typical night in watching your favorite act was more like a review, like the Motown review, again, suit and tie.
Yeah.
Nothing close to theatrics and props, man, and we lasers.
We had the Phantom of the Opera going on like a mug. I mean, I mean, you know, it was a stage. It was bigger than all of us. I mean, because we wasn't going for the Shure PA system, you know, the little baby microphones. I mean, we were going for the big boy stuff, you know, and that was partially George's idea and my idea as far as we want to do it like the white boys,
mm-hmm.
you know? I mean, why put us on stage with a baby PA when you know we're going to blow that shit up, you know? So, you know, but that's the way we were always treated. So we had to start taking our own money and reinvesting. Yeah, investing in PAs. I had Maryland Sound make this thing I call the space base station. It was up in the middle of the Coliseum, and it would spin in a certain part of the show, and the bass solo stuff would come out of it, you know. And that was in that year you're talking about, 1978.
So the speakers would rotate?
Yeah, well, they would turn. Okay, while it's in the middle of the Coliseum or Auditorium, it would turn. And the speakers, you know,
would rotate.
Yeah, would rotate. And the sound would come off the stage and up here. So it's like an earlier version of a 3D effect with sound.
Wow. What does a writer look like for you guys at this point? I would be scared as a promoter.
Because there's so many of y'all.
Y'all different.
Yeah, it was pretty deep, but... Again, we wasn't. I don't think we were that kind of band where, you know, everybody was tripping. You know, if a mug can get a sandwich, we was cool.
Oh, that's it. Not a special kind of drink that y'all needed. A
just because we could. Right. I think a lot of them did it, but you know, it wasn't really about none of that with us. You know, it was more about we came to give up the funk and we're gonna turn this mother out. That was the whole thing. You know,
when I was a kid, I read about problems with using the name the rubber band.
Sweatband.
Yeah.
What was the sweatband project?
No,
the rubber band. No. Like, did someone try to sue for the rubber band?
It was a country and western guy. That's funny you said that because I was just reading over the. Because
there's always been Bootsy's Rubber Band to me, but
yeah. Well, they were saying that we took his name, Rubber Band, and nobody never heard of him. I mean, you know, he came in and, you know, just because we were being successful and, you know, wanted some money, wanted to get paid.
But didn't a rubber band exist then? I don't get it.
Yeah, that's what he meant.
But I mean the actual rubber band that was in existence. So
yeah.
How could you claim that?
Well, I mean, you know, they'll claim anything. Ownership.
You're right.
I mean, ownership, come on, man. Right. I mean, we were blessed to get away with. They didn't sue me.
Right, the rubber band.
Yeah.
Right, yeah.
Well, no, I think you're saying the actual literal, no.
Yes.
When you are a unit, you have to register your name.
Right, right.
Like, I own the Roots as, if you're a group, you can't be named the Roots.
Right.
But then a movie can be made, or, yeah.
Or a clothing brand.
And then today, you got to understand that what Quest is saying, you know, that's everyday known fact. Then, brothers didn't know nothing.
But see, Juicy Fruit still came, tried to come after James M. Toomey, but they just didn't win. That's why I was like, you know,
right.
They're going to try.
Yeah, Oh, yeah. That's their thing. Mm-hmm. They come and take it, you know. They don't care, you know. It's like, it's mine. I don't care who came up with it. I mean, it is mine.
So was that why you did the one off the Sweatband project? Was that because of that?
Well, Sweatband didn't have nothing to do with what Quest is talking about. Quest talking about the rubber band.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And then we didn't call it the rubber band. It was always Bootsy's rubber band.
Right.
So that's the other part of it that we had in our favor. We wasn't going around trying to sell the rubber band. You know, it was Bootsy's rubber band. So I think that's how we won that. Warners came in and blew because they were so cocky, because dude had already got with them about, you know, give me a little settlement and everything's cool. They were like, man, you know, we own this. You know, so it's Warner Brothers.
What was it like dealing with Mo Austin and the cats at Warners? Like, did you have a relationship with them at all?
I did, but not with Mo. Bob Krasnow. Okay. Was the cat. We had a good relationship, real good, you know. At the time I was doing really good and doing what I'm supposed to do. So it was good, you know, but they wasn't into investing in something that they had no idea that we look like maniacs, man. Come on.
But they knew it worked.
Well, no, I can't say that.
They knew somebody loved it.
They knew, yeah, there you go. They knew somebody, and they knew who the somebody was.
We don't get it, but somebody loves it.
Yeah.
Oh, and, so that's the...
Yeah. So if Neil Bogart hadn't come in and like basically financed the 77 tour?
Right.
Like, where do you think P-Funk would have been?
Well, I think we would have been somewhere, but, you know, something would have happened. I don't exactly know what. But we was at a point that it had to happen, you know, and it just happened that Neil stepped up.
Because he's like pretty much the only one, I guess you could say, that saw the vision.
Yeah. He's the only one, you know.
By 78, you were such a character figure. Was there any talk whatsoever about you having your own cartoon? Because you guys would have full-blown, comic books inside the record.
The Pooh Show cartoon.
That's all within... Our crew within.
Wow, Bill is pulling out.
Oh man! Wow! Yeah. Wow!
Oh man, I haven't seen this since I was like
Overton Lloyd. Yeah,
10.
Yeah, I mean, it was so much talent around that whole P-Funk thing, man. It was just incredible. But what it was, Quest, was they didn't want that kind of thing. That was too, you know, it had to be lightweight. You had to be talking about just love. Just, you know, I love you, baby, and da-da-da-da-da, and dressing nice, and they didn't want that raw pee crap, and, you know.
On Saturday mornings.
They didn't want none of that, man.
But it's definitely ready for Adult Swim now, though. Like that.
Oh, yeah.
Man, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Well, just the way that the shows began and all that stuff, you guys would show, like, the 3-4-minute cartoons at the beginning. Yeah.
But guess who bought those? We did. I mean, wasn't nobody helping with George, you know, had to come up with the money with the, with the mothership. Wasn't nobody helping?
Wow.
You know? And they knew how big it was getting. But at the same time, it was like, don't touch them crazy mom. I mean, you know, especially George, that boy's out of his mind.
Okay. So is there any truth to the myth that, you and George would purposely go fishing in the Bermuda Triangle.
Yeah, that's not enough. That's actually true.
In hopes to get abducted or to see what happens.
Loving to get it.
Ooh, y'all was fucked up.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. What is it like being fucked up in the Bermuda Triangle? Like,
well, now that's one I can't remember.
But why go fishing in the Bermuda Triangle?
Because
it's kind of like asking for it.
Wait, I mean, do you know how heavy the tides are in the Bermuda Triangle?
No, but I'm just saying, like, if you're trying to get
and take a rope,
they did not take a rope. Kind of they ain't take. Come
I'm,
on.
What I'm saying no, is, I understand the logic behind it.
I was a yacht.
Yeah.
Or there was one night George told me about the night you were in Detroit driving, and you and George saw UFOs.
Well, actually, we drove from Detroit to Toronto.
Okay.
Yeah, we was coming out of Detroit, and that's one of the ones that I know really happened.
Come on, man. You were sober when you...
I didn't say I was sober.
Okay, well, how are we going to believe you?
I'm just saying that I know...
I believe in other life forces. So.
Yeah, I know that that happened. I know that that happened. And I also know that there's some missing time that happened that day, night, whatever it was. First, it was day. And next thing we know, it was night. And Chuck Berry was on there singing Johnny Be Good.
On the radio.
On the radio.
Oh, wow.
And that's when George told me, after we saw this,
nobody going to believe this?
Yeah. After we actually saw this come down and hit the car.
What?
Yeah. I looked at George, because I'm always looking up to George like, you know, he's the savior. He knows everything, you know, and... You know, I'm not afraid. That's like, you know, being out there with the Bermuda Triangle. Right. Shoot, I'm with George. You know, I mean, I'll be anywhere. We night fishing. You know, and you can't even see your
Wait,
hands.
Wait, you doing it at night?
You can't.
Was
see
there
your
a full
hands.
Moon out too?
No.
Oh, y'all just
right. The moon
was
asking bigger.
For it, man. I mean, and George caught this. We don't know what it was. We never got a chance to pull it in. It went under the boat. And he couldn't pull it in. So we don't know what happened that night, because you can't see your hand in front of your face, you know? So, yeah, it was some deep, experiences. That one you was talking about, though, in Detroit, Toronto.
Yeah.
We went to George's house over in Toronto after that experience. Knocked on the door, and his daughter answered the door, and she was in shock. By the way, we look. She said, "What is wrong with you, motherfuckers?" Because we were lit up. She said we were lit up. Okay, now this is her rap,
right?
And she don't know. I mean, you know, she's a little girl growing up, Barbarella.
That's her name.
Yeah. And you know, she. What happened to y'all? You know, and we thinking we just, you know, we got scared out of our mind. Mm-hmm. We didn't know we had a certain look. And sure enough, soon as she saw us, what is wrong with y'all? You know, so, and we never talked about it. George and I never talked about it because I wasn't sure about, you know, the facts. And I knew he wasn't sure because he was he was more confused than I was.
Another singer I had a question about was Leslyn Bailey.
Yeah.
The one who sings on Love Vibes. Yeah. What's the deal with her?
You know, I met Leslyn, let's see, in 1973 or 4. And we started doing... You know, little recordings and stuff.
Okay.
Like around in Cincinnati. And I first thought that, well, actually, she was a part of the band in the very first record. What was the Love Vibes?
Love Vibes, yep.
And because I hadn't really put the whole band together yet. So, you know, it was myself, Bone, Cat, Frankie and Fred, now I had called them to come in to do the horn thing. But the band, the actual touring band, wasn't together yet.
Okay.
You know, so I was trying to find myself, find out who the actual rubber band was going to be, you know. And she was part of that.
Okay.
And she was She was a heck of a songwriter, with those kind of love, you know, love vibes and that kind of thing. Yeah, yeah, that's my girl.
So by the late 70s, when you guys are just in full mood, does it get overwhelming? Because you're dealing with Parlette, Brides, Bootsy, Funkadelic, Parliament and
solo album.
All these acts. Yeah, how do you know our first phase? I mean, because it never technically ran out of gas.
Yeah.
But how did you know, like, we need a break or that sort of...
I'm going to tell you the truth. You know, I think the worst part about music is the business.
Right.
And music is so blissful. It's such a blessing. But that's the business is the thing that separates everybody. And that's what happens. It didn't only happen to us. That's what happens to pretty much everybody. You know, you start making money. Mm-hmm. You know, because when we weren't making no money, it was like, that was the best time in my life. It was when we weren't making no money. I mean, you know, when you start making the money, people start wanting to separate. Oh, you can come over here and do this with me. And you don't need them. And da, 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 da. So that all that rap starts happening. The one thing they couldn't do is separate me and George, you know. And, you know, because that came up a lot, wanting to separate, you know. But that's one thing that didn't happen, you know. But everything else, when I start figuring out that I needed a drug to go to the studio, I knew something was wrong with me. Not something wrong with anybody else. The blame stopped right here. Cause I started realizing that ain't what I do. You know, I used to go to the studio cause I love to do music, you know, but now I can't go out the house without doing drugs first. You know, I knew something was wrong with me. And so I think that hit everybody at a certain, in this time period, that maybe not the same way it hit me, but it was hitting everybody.
Do you think it was it trying to deal with the fame, like being like actually famous?
Yeah,
I mean,
nobody give us no manual on how to, you know. I mean, Quest and them, they know more about, you know, everything. You know, we was just out there. We was just out there, you know, for the experience and the love of music, you know. George is the only one in the camp, I think, even had a clue about how Motown worked. Or how, you know,
the business works.
Yeah, the business work. You're supposed to, you know, try to get a hit, try to make sure you got a hook, and try to make sure you got, you know, he was the only one that had a little clue, you know, but he didn't have nobody to push him. You know, he was it. Man. You know,
what were your thoughts once? Whoa, even before that. You technically are the producer of the first Zap album. Mm-hmm. You're listed on it.
Yeah, yeah.
Describe, I still don't think that the world knows what a virtuoso Roger Troutman was a musician.
Well, you know, I knew Roger before any of that stuff.
So you knew him from the hood? And
yeah, yeah. And we used to play in the same clubs. I mean, you know, when he was Roger in the Human Body, you know. And so we used to go to their gigs. They used to come to our gigs. And we used to joke a lot about his dad. You know, his dad always used to come down on me about I stole his cigarettes. And I'm like, come on, Dad, I don't even smoke. Well, not them, not right, that,
right.
No.
Right. You
know?
Right.
And, you know, we always had a big joke about that. And Roger and them always had a big motor home because had it going on.
What?
No, Dad had it going on.
What did he do?
He was in construction and, you know,
they still have a big they invested in, they have a big giant construction.
Oh, they had it awesome. Going. They had it going on. Out of all the bands, they had it going on with music or without it, yeah. You know. And so, you know, we always made it's kind of like a pledge to each other that if I make it first, you know, I'm going to reach back and grab you. If you make it first, you reach back and grab me. That was our whole thing. And Catfish didn't let me forget it. You know, when we mess around, start making it, Cat say, don't forget about Roger now. And that's when we start, you know, I was like, okay, let's, where they playing at? Cat always was in tune with the street, you know. He always knew, oh, yeah, them mother, they playing up in Dayton tonight. Let's roll up there, you know. We jump in the limo, or we was big timing like a mug then. you know, we jump in the limo, ride up, call Roger, come on, man, come on, jump in the limo. Let's rap, man, let's rap. We getting ready to get this deal, man. You know, so we talked about it, and they was all up for it. Next thing you know, we arrive in the studio, United Sounds in Detroit City.
Y'all made move across to the house at United Sounds?
Yeah.
What was United Sounds like? Was it just a regular studio to you, or just was there anything magical about it?
I hear that it was a magical place. And for, well, I guess I would have to say it's a magical place because that's where I found myself.
Right. I was going to say, like.
Yeah. Yeah, I would have to say that because when I first started going there, you know, it was like, the engineer, you know, he'd hate to see me coming because I always had some kind of pedal to hook up. And, you know, he's like, man, you know, because he was used to doing like Motown stuff. You just plug it in and play, you know, just come on in, throw that shit in the wall, let's hit it, you know. But I'll come in, you know, I'll be figuring out my gadgets, you know, trying to get this sound. And he's like, what are you doing? Just play the part, you know? I'm like, no, man, you don't understand. See, I didn't even understand what I was doing. I was just trying to get some different things going on, you know? And so I would have to always hear this going into the studio. I would know I would have to deal with Jim. Jim is his name, Jim Vitti. I'll put him on lock.
Oh, all
yeah, 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 yeah. Yeah, Jim Vitti, he was a smash though, man. That mug, you know, once he caught on to what I was doing, he was like, you know, is that all the pedals you got? You know, he's like, bring them, you know, because he started understanding, oh, I see what you're doing.
So since you're mentioning engineering, the claps on all P-Funk.
Jim Vitti. Yes.
How?
Yeah.
Because the electronic harmonizer. Technology wasn't out.
Harmonizer. The Eventide harmonizer.
And Eventides were out back then?
Eventide and AM, what was that thing? AMS? Did it only sample for a minute?
So he would
detune it? No, it wasn't even a minute. It was 5 or 10 seconds.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. That was, you know, Jim Vitti came up with that vibe.
And is that y'all clapping or y'all, how are you creating that?
We all big claps? Out in the studio, you know, all out in the studio, clapping at the same time, you know, and it's making that
The Isley Brothers once told me that.
Wetting your hands?
Yeah, they put their hands in a bucket and then start clapping. But
Well, I don't know. That might work for them.
For them, but not for you guys.
Yeah, you know, we just all went out and just clapped, you know.
So how... Were you surprised at how your catalog slowly started to come back into fashion in the late 80s and early 90s?
You know what, Quest? I was never really surprised about
that. I'm the shit.
Yeah, I mean, on the real. Really? You know, I was always kind of just looking forward to the experience and... When they start sampling and stuff like that, it was like, oh, great. I got, you know, great. I'm glad somebody really
You're like, we won't
okay,
easy.
So can we talk about I'd Rather Fuck With You?
Yeah.
Because that's like my favorite use of a Bootsy sample. I just remember the first time I heard it in high school and it was like, what the fuck is this? This is amazing. When the first time you heard it and were asked, is it cool? Can we use this?
Well, actually, he played it for me before it even came out.
Right.
You know, and...
To get the permission, right?
Yeah. And, you know, we would just.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Not even a question. Just.
Right. Right. Just go ahead and hit it, you know. And you know what? We wasn't even really getting paid at that point.
Right.
You know, so it was more for me. It was more about the rebirth, like you was talking about.
Yeah, because when you started doing it in concert, then it's like, this is where.
Right, yeah. Yeah. So for me, it was, you know, it was more of that. And then James, I think, was the first one that started, you know, what do you call it, suing and for the samples and stuff. But George and I was pretty cool with, you know,
they legendarily cut great deals. Like the, I think the Not Just Needy rate was, I think, half a penny an album sold.
Yeah.
What?
Because George's theory was like, it was like crack.
Yeah.
Let's sell it for cheap, and then everybody will come and use us.
So in comparison, I'm wondering what James would charge.
Oh, James. Oh, God. Oh, no, that,
I mean, he's not. I mean,
picture this, Learjet.
True that.
Picture this. True that. $250,000 a week for gas.
Whoa.
Oh, man.
For gas.
He wasn't as, which is just with the suit. I mean, he definitely went back to, you
get
know,
get his money, right?
Get his money. But I think he also realized that, you know, where the bread's being buttered. Now, you know, the state just absolutely encourages it. Yeah. And I'm like, well, y'all know, like, James Brown hasn't been sampled in, like, 25 years now. They're like, yeah, well, anytime we want to use it. Here's some more things.
Right.
Boosie, at this point in your career, like, where is most of your money coming from? Is it shows? Is it, like, publishing on or royalties on your records?
You want to know the truth? I don't know when the hell is money coming from. I mean, you know, and I think by me not caring, it just comes. And that's the way it's been all my life.
Wow. So you have a very trusting individual in your life.
Well, it ain't like trusting. It's more like I depend on the one, period. You know, and the one is bigger than music. The one is all of us. It's the essence of all it is. And so that's what I depend on. You know, it's no religion.
Okay.
You know, it's no nothing. It's no color. You know, it's the one. Whatever that one is, our minds can't grasp what it is. And so I don't even try to figure it out. I never have.
Like Bootsy.
Yeah, I never try to figure it out. It's like, oh, that's what it is? Okay.
So you've done some collaborations with a lot of artists, like people might know you,
Delight.
Did the Delight project, but this one particular project, I will never for the life of me. When it happened,
what was it, man?
The Bill Laswell.
No, you were in Color Me Bad's band.
Oh yeah,
for,
what? The second album. Oh, wow. Second, yeah. Not even the second first. Album.
You, if you remember the very beginning sketch of Fat Cat.
I thought I was on a roll.
Fantastic,
man.
Volume 1.
Okay.
When they were like, hook him up a good meal.
Yeah, yeah.
Hey,
yeah.
Yeah. Well, like,
I thought I was on a roll.
You're good. But what Frank Dank and Dilla are talking about
is the intro to Time and Chance.
Yeah, yeah. Time and Chance by Call Me Bent. They did it on the Soul Train Awards the night before. And even I was like, wait, is Bootsy playing with Color Me Bad? Like, is he?
Yeah.
He's on the album, too.
But, you know, I think, too, what I was doing was trying to prepare myself to get back into band. You know, and it wasn't so much as whose band. It was like, let me see where I can fit in.
I'm not clowning. I mean, it actually made sense.
Yeah. How they hit the lottery like that? I don't.
But they.
That's when they were hot, kind of at that time.
They were hot.
After I won a section. Okay. All right.
Yeah. And it just seemed, like I said, how the one takes care of me.
The one, yeah.
I mean, with Delight now. I mean, of all times, of all people, and house music,
right,
Bootsy.
Right.
You know, even George said, man, you can't do that.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. And then I invited him to the gig. He came to the gig. He said, oh, I see.
I get it.
I see. I mean, seeing all this festival and all of them jump him, he was like, okay, I get it. Yeah.
See, this is all making sense now. You're taking chances, because I was wondering when I heard you were doing something with Billy Ray Cyrus, I was like,
yeah.
Then I'm like, okay, this is Boosie. He on the one. He taking chance. You never know what could come out of
this. I don't want to do it with who you would think I would want.
You know what? I forgot. All the stuff we did together, I'm totally forgetting. So, Bootsy and I once did, they like redid the Monday Night Football theme. And they had the All-Star.
That was the bomb.
It was me, Bootsy, Little Richard, a whole bunch of people. But one of the craziest moments was on break, Charlie Daniels.
Oh, you remember that?
Starts playing the P-Funk catalog. I didn't realize how deep into soul music Charlie Daniels was. Yeah. Wow. And he was eating it up, the whole fact that, like, oh, y'all underestimated me. Yeah, I know my P-Funk. But, I mean, he was doing, like
deep album
good to your ear hole. He's what?
Oh, yeah. Yep.
Wow.
Yeah. And I was like, what the hell? And I did not know that.
That's crazy.
And these two were just jamming, like,
but you know what's funny too is I run into a lot of cats that ain't, you know, you ain't supposed to be really down with, and I find out that they know more about you than you do.
Undercover fucketeers.
Yeah.
They don't want the world to know.
Yeah. And it's like, wow. You know, so
you're a living legend, Bootsy. I don't know if I told you.
You're a timeless living legend.
Well, you know, like I said, I didn't get into it to be what that is, because I don't even know. But I'm just glad to still be able to, you know, to sit here and be amongst people and to vibe the good vibe, because it's so much mess. Mm-hmm. You know, it's so much mess that's going on. And you know, just to be able to use your platform. That's what I feel like whatever I have done, I want to use the platform for these young mugs that's coming up now, because they didn't get the platform to play live music like we did. You know, they got an iPhone. They got an iPhone and that's all they need. You know, but we needed to be able to touch and feel people, you know, and have those private moments, you know, because you can't even have a secret now. Ain't nothing private. You know, you can't even get lost.
You're right.
You know what I'm saying? No,
I had a question about the record Instant Replay by Michael Wade.
Oh, yeah.
Man, is that you playing on that?
He produced the record.
Right? Oh, you produced
I produced the record. I'm trying to think.
Instant Replay, that's like, you and me.
Yeah.
One more.
Yeah, okay.
Play another love song.
Right. I remember the record, but I'd have to hear the song to know if I'm playing on it.
Oh, okay.
That's
how much he's done.
Yeah. But you did produce you produced. Yeah. Okay,
well, Cooking from the Inside Out.
I love that record.
Yeah, sort of.
Cooking from the Inside Out.
Yeah. I had that tape.
Dad, man, Quest, you got everything, man.
None. We're just nerds, man.
All right, Quasar or the Glenn Golan side. Yeah. Were you on that? Were you playing on that as well? You wasn't on that one. Okay.
Gotcha. Oh, but the boys is bad, man.
Okay.
Jersey, man. Come on, man.
Wait, when Paul billionaire.
Paul.
I don't know. You're crazy.
I was like, I'm thinking Paul.
Bill Gates' former partner. Paul,
almost said
music
Manafort.
Experience in Seattle.
Oh, I can't Allen, remember.
Paul Allen.
Paul
when,
Allen.
When Paul Allen reunited you guys to do the JBs.
Yeah. Yeah.
What was that? Was that the first time that you guys played together? And
well,
what year was
you
this?
Mean? All of us, like all
it,
of us.
It had to been like 2002.
It was 2002. Oh, okay. Yeah. Actually, that was as far as all of us, like country.
Yeah, the original.
Yeah, the original crew. Yeah. Right. Yeah, that was definitely the first time, you know. And check this out, you know. So, you know, they asked James, you know, now we got your original band, you know, cats here,
mm-hmm.
you know. Now, why don't you want to play with them?
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah, yeah. He didn't want to play with us.
Wow.
And he didn't play with us. So we had to, we went on before him, tore it up, all right, mind you, mm-hmm. playing his stuff, mind you. And then he came on.
With his band.
With his band. Nope. And, you know, people kind of nope. saw, yeah, they kind of saw him later.
What did he say to you? Did he speak to y'all?
Oh, well, you know, he came in the room, come on in, you know. And what me and Kat do, you know, we get a mug sitting in the middle of us, right? Because we like them headphones, you know. Mm-hmm. It's like we get the mug sitting in the middle and we wear that mug out. You know? Then we start cracking on him. Well, what's with the shoes, man? You know? So, you what know, we had a thing where we didn't even think about, you know, like what we going to do. It's like, Mr. Brown want to come in and see y'all. Yeah, well, come on, tell him, come on in. And then I move over, Cat move over. James gonna sit right there. We put our, cause you know he ain't used to the hugging shit. You know, so you know we hug. First thing he do is he sit down, hug him. Then he get all uncomfortable. It's like, yeah, that's exactly the way we want you, man. That's the way you made us feel.
Ah, man, but we know it's love. Yeah. We know it's love. So, is there anything that you've not done that you wish you could do or?
What I've not done is
you scored a movie. I forgot you even scored Superbad,
right?
Superbad, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Was in well, actually, that was
almost the JB's.
All, yeah, yeah, almost yeah. all of them.
Yeah, yeah.
Clyde was there. Mm-hmm. Jabbo, and Bernie Worrell came in. Catfish, actually,
a mashup all stars of.
Yeah, yeah. It was really that was a cool time. Now that you mentioned it, mm-hmm. I got some great tapes of Jabbo and Clyde, you know, during that session.
Really?
I mean, yeah, and we had the video, I got tapes. I mean, they was killing. Man. They was killing. They was killing. And I already know.
Yeah, yeah, that. What
does your archives look like? Because, you know, there's a lot of your shows, like, on YouTube or whatever, but, like,
You know what I do, Quest? I just stack stuff, you know, and it's just like my music. I don't go back and listen to it. I just know I got it.
Do you need an archivist?
Uh-huh.
Do you need somebody?
Well, at some
he does,
point,
Bill. Yes, he does.
At some point,
I'm volunteering.
Yeah, yeah, because that I think that's coming. It's coming around, you know, because everybody's really asking me. And I got, it's so many different artists that's been through there that, you know, like, for instance, Bobby Womack, man. People have no idea how bad that boy is on the guitar.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I mean, singing, he's killing it. But the guitar, he's killing it even more. And I got these tracks that we did when we did the record before this one. And, you know, he brings you in. It's this spiritual thing with Bobby. He just brings you in, and whatever he's feeling, you feel it.
Actually, you mentioned Bobby Womack.
Yeah.
Which made me think of Breezin.
Yep.
Which made me think of him recording in the same studio as There's a Riot Going On.
Yep. Yep.
Okay. Can you, as honest as you can be about it,
mm-hmm.
what was that miniature Sly period like when Sly kind of joined P-Funk?
And with us. Yeah, yeah.
Because the thing is that I know that during that P-Funk Earth Tour, mm-hmm. or which I think it was the Funkadelic, oh, no, it was Motor Booty Affair, 78. I know that he was opening for you guys.
Right, right.
And, you know, George had him on a few records. It was okay. But I, every time I look at the footage of any old footage of Sly in the P-Funk era, I gotta wonder how much of a psychological, pardon my French, mind fuck that was for him.
Yeah.
To
yeah.
like,
you're right.
Him as a captain. Kind of, he has to go down to minion status.
And he's opening for me.
How awkward it was that period.
I know that had to be really stupid for him, and it was felt stupid to me. I can't speak for nobody else.
But I know that, you know, you guys had nothing but love for him, and you know, like, you wanted to.
He's like one of my hero, and you know, to actually see him going through that at that time, I thought it was good because at least he had came back out of his shell,
right?
You know, so I thought that part of it was good. But the agony that I can feel that, you know, was coming from him to have to do that to get his legs back.
Right.
You know, I know that agony, too. I felt that. I felt that before.
You felt
when that? Did you feel that?
I can't say exactly when I felt it, but I know I felt that. You know,
who was the artist that you were looking at that's kind of you saw as, if not the next you, but
well,
like,
well, it didn't necessarily have to be in that same way.
Okay.
that it happened. It's just that feeling. I've felt that before.
I understand.
You know,
see, I would. That's okay. That's news to me because I would still feel as though you are still Bootsy, unmistakably Bootsy Collins. Like your presence is such, if you're standing with Snoop, if you're doing stuff with, you know, rapper of the moment, whatever.
Yeah.
And you know, millennials aside, somebody knows that's Bootsy Collins.
Right.
Whereas
I'll tell you when it was.
Sly was kind of still.
No.
Oh, good.
I know now. This is one of the times, when you're playing to an audience that don't have a clue of who the hell is this motherfucker standing up there with, you know, got, you know, the star glasses on, and the motherfuckers don't have a clue of who you are, and all the mugs that's on the show is like, what do you call, Funketeers from what,
right.
You know, that's a time that you feel like, damn. I mean, you know, it's like,
all right,
and it ain't got nothing to do with the artists.
Right.
This has something to do with they don't know, and ain't nothing you can do.
Again, fucking millennials.
Well, it happens. But it wasn't like, you know, it was their fault.
Right. Well, it's their parents' fault.
Parents didn't school them.
This is why we have Questlove Supreme.
Yeah, parents didn't school them.
Really? Seriously.
But that's the closest time I think that I've, you know, that kind of feeling would come out. It's like, you know, when you come on and you know these mugs supposed to know something. Somebody's supposed to know something. And they don't.
Damn.
You know, and but then, you know, me being a man of the world, I kind of understand why they don't. You know, because funk was a bad word. When we first came out, you know, and they wanted us to do interviews on the radio, but they didn't want us to talk about funk. So I understand that stupid part, you know, like, how are we going to tell y'all about what the funk, you know, is about if we can't say funk, you know? So right there, that was so stupid, you know, and then it was the people that drove it home that made them realize, hey man, you motherfuckers better, you know, y'all better catch up, cause the people going for it, you know, the people was in it, you know, they was in it already, and the DJs and you know the radio, they was like, no, we can't play that shit, you know, they got airplanes in the records and you know alarms going off, you know, we can't play that on the radio, you know, so, you know, we had seen that story before.
I also think it's on us because we just can't take for granted that someone's, if I say flashlight, you'll know what I'm talking about.
Right.
I mean, you know, there's sports events. It's each one teach one.
Yeah.
If you leave this earth and didn't at least teach 20 people about your playlist or whatever is on, then that's what's going to happen.
I still blame the parents because it was in my house where I learned about Miles, Amber, both Phil, you know, Ted. Like, it's just.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I'll do that too.
But you know what? It's a lot of kids that get it like that.
Yeah.
And then you have a lot that don't, you know? So yeah, it's true. Like, right. You know, so it's like you get the best of both worlds every now and then.
You also have to look at the way people's music collections are these days. Like, it's not necessarily like a physical object in your house. Like, there's not a stack of vinyl sitting in the corner of most people's houses.
People aren't making mixtapes.
80,000 records are in this telephone right now.
Right, yeah. Right.
And so, it's kind of,
and when you have access to that much, you kind of lose context for it all.
So Quest, let me ask you, how do you feel now, you know, because you have moved, checked it out. Just let me ask.
Okay.
Just let me ask. You have moved from crates, right?
Uh-huh.
And then just to have the availability, what does that make you feel like? I mean, you know.
You know, I miss the immersive experience of record shopping. Mainly because that was the bonding thing with my dad and I.
Yeah.
My dad and I would go to the mom and pop store. Yeah. And he was a bin shopper the way I am now. So, you know, after school, go to a record store and just buy every 45, every record. So I miss, you know, the incense in the store and, you know, him playing this record and that record. I miss that experience.
Well, just think about this.
But on the other hand, I'm fully embracing technology now, and there's so much music out there on the internet. I mean, it's overwhelming, and I'm probably not even going to get through 25% of it.
Very overwhelming.
But you know, I'm kind of aboard for the ride. You know?
Yeah. Well, I guess the same kind of thing you're dealing with there is kind of what we're dealing with as well, you know, because the crate is what we do, you know, that's the crate of music. And what they're doing now is they're making it where you don't have to carry the crate, you know, so if you don't carry the crate with you, then they give you a replacement, you know, which the replacement, you know,
It's your phone.
And, I mean, and that's where the future.
People play guitar on that phone. That's kind of crazy.
I know. But that's where it's going. You know, that's where it's going.
That's where it is.
Yeah.
All right. Are there any regret questions?
What was your thoughts on Redbone first time you heard it?
Yes.
My Childish Gambino?
Yeah. My Childish Gambino.
I thought it was pretty good. I mean, I liked it.
Okay.
You know, I knew the Rather Be With You was... I knew that was all up in there. Mm-hmm. You know, it wasn't sampled, but they, you know, they recreated the way they heard it.
Yeah.
You know, I thought it was a great record.
Wait, so that doesn't...
Bill might hint that you're being diplomatic right now, but, you know.
Yeah, because there was a big debate online about this because
Let me tell you, you know.
If you
I'm just
be honest here.
Yeah, I'm going to be honest.
Thank you.
Okay.
Oh, no. Why did I open this door?
Now...
I'm a fan of that song.
My partner, George, he's actually, what I understand is he's going after him, you know. And, you know, that's what George do.
Because I was going to ask, was there a sample check or how does...
Because like, they didn't sample it.
They didn't sample it or interpolate it. It's just, it's kind of
I didn't know that.
What, that was I'd Rather Be With You?
No, I thought that... There was some clearance going on. You mean it was done and not even
inspired by?
Yeah, it was just inspired by.
Oh wait,
it's some blurred mind shit.
Wait, Fonte just gave me that nigga.
No, I wasn't doing it at you.
I knew it was derivative.
When I called you that, when I texted, I was like, I heard that record. I was like, he might be in blurred lines.
Here's the thing though, because we don't have physical copies of it.
Nobody knows.
I've never read the credits of that album. I've just heard the song. Naturally assume, they cleared that shit. Everyone knows this derivative of I'd Rather Be With You.
That was the debate because they said, remember y'all said a lot of millennials will not know where this comes from.
Oh, damn, Donald, you done fucked up, bro.
That's why Bill didn't fuck with it in the first place.
So y'all are not credited as like co-writers on that song or nothing? That's okay, all right.
Anyway, Bill just got happy, and we have to wrap up this episode.
I have something to ask about.
We were supposed to go back to talk about this. What did James think about your guitar?
You didn't forget that.
I wrote it down so I wouldn't forget.
Oh my goodness. Okay, that first night we played, I had that green $29 silver tone guitar, which I turned into a bass. And I played it. I thought, you know, the color of it was just, let me see if y'all got a green.
Not the grand black around here.
Yeah. Okay, take this blue and neon green it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that's the color of this bass, okay? And James looked at that mother and he was like, son, nah. This is what he would do. Nah, ain't gonna work. Ain't gonna work, son. That thing you got there can't ever be on my stage again. On my stage.
You play wherever the hell else you want.
Did you stand out too much?
I don't think it was that. It's just he didn't know the story. He didn't know that I was blessed just to have that.
So did he buy you a bass?
He bought me a bass.
Oh. You still have that bass?
Actually, I don't.
Oh. What was the story about it turning into a snake on the...
Yeah, I heard that story too.
That was what
bad
happened.
Tripping.
Yeah. Well, it actually, I thought it was pretty good. but obviously other people that was looking thought it was bad.
Right.
So, what happened was, James, son, look at your eyes. They're all red. I know you doing them drugs. I'm like, I don't do it on your set. I do not, you know. And anybody would be crazy outside of Catfish to.
That was a loaded statement.
I mean, to do drugs on James' set with all the movements, hits. I mean, everything he did was a band. Yeah. And it was like, I can't be high on the stage, you know. Even I know that. Right. You know. So you don't have to drill me on doing drugs, because, yeah, I'm going to do them, but I ain't going to do them on your set. So that's what I told him. And every time he called me, look at your eyes, son. And I'd be looking crazy. But it was because of the sweat. Okay. You know, the sweat done dripped in my eyes. Maybe I stayed up all night, you know, with this, that, and the other one. And, you know, and all of that played into 7 nights a week. So every night he called me in there, I'm going to look crazy. You know, it ain't going to be one good night. So he called me in this one night.
Uh-huh.
And that was after I had the snake experience. You know, I'm on stage, you know, because I said, if he gonna accuse me, I'm gonna let it be real. I'm gonna take some LSD tonight.
Oh,
and so I
might as well do it.
I might as well. I mean, he gonna accuse me anyway, so I took it. I could, now, you talking about recalling that night? No. I have no idea.
And no mess ups either, huh?
And no mess ups.
I know.
Nobody complained about nothing I played. You know,
it's like the Doc Ellis no hitter.
Right.
I don't even know how I got through that night, but I winded up in James' room.
Okay.
And, you know, he said to me, come here, son, sit down over here. And he put me right next to him. I mean, right next to him. You know, it was like, you know, I need a little room because I need, you know, it's like I'm tripping. You know, and you know, I couldn't tell him that, but it's like, don't you know? And see, what he's so deep is he knew that I was tripping, and he just gonna mess my trip up. He gonna mess it up. So he called me, get real close to him, because he don't never have me getting that close.
Right.
You know, so I got so close to him that when he was talking, I had to look at him, you know. And when I looked at him, his face started, like, you know how volcanoes look? The volcano with the stuff spewing out of them?
Yeah, yeah.
I started seeing his pores just, you know, all over his face. And the next thing you know, I fell out on the floor.
No.
Check it out. Fell out dying laughing. He was so through with me. He said, "Nogo, get your ass up out of here." He told the bodyguards, "Throw me out."
Wow.
And that was the last time that he called me back in his room to talk, to give me a lecture.
A drug talk.
Yeah, yeah. You know, because every night he would call me in the room to tell me how bad I was, how messed up, you know, how I wasn't on the one. Son, you ain't got it. You still ain't got it. And see, we be done killed the people. The people be like, damn, them boys, oh, man, them motherfuckers, oh, that. So you get all that rap. Then James call you in the back. Son, you ain't got it. You wasn't on the one tonight. You know. So every day we went in there, that's the story I got.
And you think that was his way of just kind of keeping y'all humble with not getting the big head?
But check it out. Okay. It was a little deeper than that. The more he said that, the more it made me want to practice. You know. Mm. I never knew it at the time. But once I got out of the thing and looked back, I was practicing hard in a mug because I thought we wasn't happening, you know? And I don't think he was doing it for that purpose. I think he was doing it just to wear me out because that's what he do, you know? He wear a mug out. But if you take it in a positive way, you can help your situation, you know? And that's why, you know, a lot of negative stuff that come down, some of it's good for you. Some of it will, you know, if you take it in a positive way, some of it'll make you get on it. You Word. Know. So that particular one made me get on it, and what nothing nobody could say that was deeper than James Brown about, you ain't on it. You know, cuz I hear that voice all the time.
You still hear it now?
I still hear it now.
Man,
you know. And it makes me want to do that much better, you know. But I know the reasoning now. But then I didn't know why he was doing it. I thought he was just doing it just to wear me out, you know, to make me throw my instrument down, you know, and say I can't handle it, you know. But it made me grab my instrument more, you know, and take a hold of that, wow. You know. And, and like I said, I don't think he was doing that on purpose. But then again, he might have, because James was deep.
Any other?
Nah, I think I'm good for this.
You good, Fine?
Yeah, I think we covered it.
Bye.
Random question. Did anybody, any stylist ever try to get up in your business and be like, I think I could do some things?
You mean stylist?
He's yeah. clearly his own stylist.
No, clearly he is, but at some Pat. Point somebody was like.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, you know, it was lots of people that did that. But, well, it was only a select few that would come in and, you know, I always drew what I wanted.
Wow.
You know, because if I hadn't been a musician, I was going to definitely, yeah. Because that's all I did in school was draw.
Well, I do want to know, how many star glasses do you have? And have you ever, do that's you like ever go tape. Out and disguise yourself by not dressing like you?
Yeah.
Just so
yeah.
you can, you know, yeah. you got to go to Whole Foods and get some
Actually,
bread.
I had to figure that out. I mean, once you make that monster, you know, the monster turns on you. I didn't find that out until it turned on me. You know, that Bootzilla we was talking about?
Right.
When that monster turned on me, I was like, I didn't know what to do. I didn't know who I was, you know. And when he turns on you, you just, you know. So I had to find myself again, you know, find out the William. You know, I had to find William again.
William Earl.
Yeah, right. My mother named me William. I had to find that boy that took out the garbage. Now go on out there, take that garbage out. I had to find him again because I was so into Bootsy and Bootzilla that I lost that boy, you know, until I came home one day and Mama slapped these same glasses off my face and said, nigga, get out there and take out that damn garbage. And I had all my friends with me.
I don't do that no more, Mom.
No, I didn't say that.
Never mind.
No. Right. That's exactly what I did. I was fully dressed. She was like, you better get your ass in there and take out that damn garbage. I went straight to the garbage.
She was talking to William.
She was talking to William. And that's where I started to find William again. Gotcha. It's when she did that. Oh. Yeah. That's a true story.
Steve?
The star glasses.
Yeah.
Do they pinch your nose or dig into your cheeks at all? The you points of the stars. Does that hurt at all?
No, it might look like it, but
actually, that's a great question, yeah. Steve.
You know, and then the other part of the question is, I got asked this a few times too. What is the star glasses all about?
And the star period, because on your hat too.
Yeah. And why did you make your glasses mirror? You know, and my answer was, I did it in mirror, so who's ever looking at me? You know, at the time it was it was a lot of kids that would come to the show, and you know, because I dealt with a lot of geepies, the fans that the Funkadelic was too, older kids, mm-hmm. right? But I started getting the younger kids,
six,
the seven, eights. So I started calling them geepies, and so I got these the star glasses. So when the kid look in my eyes, instead of them seeing me, they see themselves, and
that's beautiful. Boo.
That's the mic drop moment.
Yeah, but that's what this was all about. And with the bass, if you notice the first space bass, it's got the mirror mm-hmm. on the as a bodyguard. Mm-hmm. And what I did with that was, I wanted the lights when they hit me from the stage, I wanted those lights to hit the bass and bounce off the bass. So all of that, now all of that was thought out. You know, now I'd admit most of the stuff we never even, but the glasses and the image, I was already on that in school.
That was important.
When I said I was drawing a lot in school, stick man with the star glasses, with the star bass, that was the beginning of it. I didn't know that I was going to wind up actually being that guy, but that's what came to me.
That's amazing, man.
So, and then when George gave me the opportunity to front the Bootsy Rubber Band, I was like, oh, I already know what I'm going to do. I got to find somebody to make these star glasses, and I got to find somebody to make the star bass. And I was on a mission.
Well,
yeah,
William Earl Bootsy Collins, we thank you very much for sharing your experience.
Man.
Thank you. Man. This was awesome. I never knew I remembered all of that stuff myself. Oh, man.
Jesus, that was more than I bargained for. I didn't think you would remember these stories.
Those ones there, but a lot of stuff, I don't have a clue.
We won't ask you about
but
that.
But those stories, yeah.
And thank you. Just for the record, because they're all over your hands, you are Scorpio?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
That says a lot. All right.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know about that, right?
He will be 23 next month. Anyway, on behalf of Boss Bill, Unpaid Bill, Fontigolo, Sugar Steve, I'm consistent. This is Questlove and my brother, Bootsy Collins.
Baba.
There you go. All right.
Over and out.
See you on the
foil, baby.
Yeah, that's right. See you on the next go round. Questlove Supreme, baby.
Questlove Supreme is a production of iHeartRadio. This classic episode was produced by the team at Pandora. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.